Okay, girls. Love you to the moon and back. Here's your next chapter. A few days later, Mrs. Willoughby called Bertha about my bad attitude. That day in school, she had asked me if I had 2/3 of a piece of pie and I wanted to give half to my sister, then how much of the whole pie would that be? I told her I wouldn't give my sister any of my pie. Everybody had laughed except Mrs. Willoughby. She had turned red and pressed her lips together and made her eyes into little squints when she looked at me. When she called Bertha that afternoon, I was stretched out in Gus's easy chair watching TV. The fat orange cat named Flora was curled in my lap. I heard Bertha say, "She did," and "Oh, dear." Then she lowered her voice, and I could only make out bits and pieces drifting through the kitchen door. A rough time, missing her family, been hard on her. Then she hung up, and I kept my eyes on the TV when she came in and sat on the couch. "That was Mrs. Willoughby," she said. A fast-talking guy on TV was pouring chocolate syrup on the floor and mopping it up with a miracle mop. "She told me you've been a little rude in school," Bertha said. Now the man on TV was showing the set of knives that came free with the miracle mop. Then Bertha started going on about how she knows how upset I must be about my family being all broken up like it is. Well, she didn't use the word broken, but she might as well have. She said she knew how it must be scary to see Mama like she was, and how I must be worried about sick about Scrappy, and how I must miss Jackie so much. I kept my eyes on the mopping man, and in my head I said, "Pineapple, pineapple, pineapple." But Howard's stupid idea didn't work, because the next thing I knew, I was hollering at Bertha. Mean words about minding her own business, and who cared about my broken up? Sorry excuse for a family. Not me, that was for sure. The words kept spewing and got louder and faster. How I hated Colby and all of those hillbilly kids in this nasty old house hanging off the side of the mountain, and those canning jars in my room, and especially those Cinderella pillowcases. And then I stalked outside, letting the screen door slam behind me and trying not to think about Bertha sitting there on the couch looking like she'd been stabbed in the heart. A couple of cats leaped out of the way as I stormed across the yard and up the driveway toward the road. I kicked at dirt and yanked on leaves and hurled gravel into the woods. When I got to the road, I didn't even care that the asphalt was burning hot under my bare feet. The mad was swirling inside me, making my eyes ring, my ears ring, and my stomach churn. But then, the next thing I knew, I was sitting in the dirt on the side of the road crying so hard I couldn't hardly breathe. What was wrong with me? Why had I said those mean things to Bertha? Why was I acting so hateful at school? And then, while I was sitting there, wallowing in my pity, somebody said, "What's the matter, Charlie?" I looked up to see Howard standing by his bicycle in front of me. I put my head on my knees and mumbled, "Nothing." "Must be something. Go away." "Nah." He laid his bicycle in the weeds by the road and sat next to me. "You have to tell me what's the matter." This boy beat all. He sure had a lot of gumption for a little old red-headed up-down boy. "I don't have to tell you anything," I said. "Then you have to tell somebody." He pushed at his glasses. "Why?" "My mama says you should never keep your troubles to yourself. She says if you share them with somebody, they get smaller." "Go away," I said. "Did you kick somebody again?" I shook my head. "Poke them with a pencil?" "No," I hollered. Mama made this needlepoint sign that says, "If all our troubles were hung on a line, you'd choose yours and I'd choose mine." I lifted my head and stared at him. "What's that supposed to mean?" "It means everybody's got troubles, and some of them are worse than yours." He yanked at a blade of grass and tossed it into the road, or something like that. Ha! That was a good one. I couldn't think of anybody with worse troubles than me. Then I looked at Howard with his eyebrows knitted together. and a look of pure worry on his face, and before I knew it, I was spilling those troubles out to him. I told him how I wished Scrappy wasn't in jail, how he and I used to play poker and watch Wheel of Fortune and eat macaroni and cheese for breakfast. I told him how scared I was when I saw my mama crying into her pillow in the dark bedroom, not even caring one little bit whether I had clean clothes or even went to school. I told him how Mama and Scrappy would holler at each other the livelong day while me and Jackie sat on her bed with the radio turned up loud so we didn't have to hear them. I told him about all the times I watched from the bedroom window when Scrappy drove off with his tires screeching and gravel flying while Mama yelled, "Good riddance to bad rubbish," from the front porch. I told him how much I missed Jackie and who knew all the words to nearly every song on the radio and would French braid my hair and share her nail polish with me. And then I told him those mean things I'd said to Bertha. When I was done, the silence settled over us, still and soft like a veil. The sun had gotten lower in the sky, sitting on top of the mountains in the distance, and the air had grown cooler. For a minute, I thought maybe Howard was embarrassed by all the stuff I'd told him, and I didn't know what to say. I was starting to wish I had never shared my troubles with him like that. But then he looked right at me and said, "Want my advice?" "Sure, I guess," I said. "You can't do nothing about Scrappy and them back in Raleigh," he said. "The only thing you can fix is what you done to Bertha." I guess he was right. I couldn't fix my mess of a family, but I could try to make things right with Bertha. I stood up and brushed the dirt off the back of my shorts, and then I couldn't hardly believe my eyes. Right there at the edge of the woods was that brown and black floppy-eared dog. I put my fingers to my lips and went, "Shh." The dog was watching me with his head cocked to the side. "Don't move," I whispered to Howard. I took one slow step toward the dog, and guess what? He wagged his tail. Two tiny little wags. That dog liked me. "Hey, fella," I said, taking another step. Then wouldn't you know it, a car came roaring up the road and whizzed past us, and that dog darted off into the woods. I stamped my foot. Dang it! I'd almost forgotten Howard was there when he said, "I've seen that dog before." "He's mine," I said. "Really?" "Well, he's gonna be." "And I bet he's full of ticks," he said, "and he might have the mange. Stray dogs have the mange." "So what?" I said. "His name is Wishbone." The minute I said that, it felt right. Wishbone. That was the perfect name for my dog. "I'm going to catch him," I said, "and then I'll bathe him and get the ticks off him and teach him tricks and let him sleep in the bed with me." "I'll help you catch him," Howard said, picking his bike up out of the weeds. "You will?" "Sure." Suddenly, Howard seemed different. He didn't seem so much like a nosy up-down boy, nagging me half to death about being my backpack buddy. He seemed more like somebody being nice to me, somebody I had shared my troubles with. I watched him get on his bike and pedal off toward his house. Then I called, "Bye, Wishbone," into the woods before I hurried up the road to make things right with Bertha. By the time I got home, it was getting dark. Gus's old rattle trap of a car was in the driveway, and the smell of spaghetti sauce drifted through the screen door. My feet felt like cinder blocks as I made my way across the yard toward the house. More than anything, I wanted to just go on back to my room and pretend like this day had never happened. But I didn't. I put one cinder block foot in front of the other until I was on the back porch, where Gus and Bertha sat gazing out at the mountain view. "Hey," I said, and my voice sounded like a sniveling baby. I kept my eyes on the leaf-covered floorboards of the porch. "Hey there," Gus said. I couldn't look at Bertha, but her silence smacked me hard. I sat down and studied the fading hearts and stars I'd drawn on my arm. From somewhere way down in the woods, a bullfrog croaked. sending his deep-throated call echoing out into the cool evening air. I counted to three in my head, and then I said it. I'm sorry, Bertha. Then I did what I'd told myself I most definitely would not do. I cried, and I swear I could not stop, no matter how much I wanted to. The worst part, it was, that I couldn't get myself to tell Bertha those things I'd practiced in my head, like how I didn't mean to holler at her, and how I don't hate this house perched on the mountainside with Pegasus up there shining over the porch, how those canning jars don't bother me one little bit, and most of all, how I love Cinderella, because who doesn't? But all I did was cry, and then Bertha was kneeling in front of me with her warm hand on my ink-stained arm. "You are a blessing in this house, Charlie," she said. A blessing? She should have called me mean and hateful and dumb and sorry, but she called me a blessing. When Gus stood up and said the perfect Gus thing, "Let's have some of that blueberry cobbler before supper." So that's what we did. The three of us sat out on the porch as the stars were beginning to twinkle up in the Carolina sky, and we ate blueberry cobbler before supper. And while Bertha told us about how her friend Racine backed her car into the flagpole at the post office that afternoon and then just drove off like nothing had ever happened, an acorn dropped from the branches of the oak tree hanging over the porch and fell right at my feet. I nearly spilled my cobbler when I jumped up and grabbed it. I had almost let the day slip by without making my wish, and now here came an acorn like it was dropped right down from heaven. I hesitated, but then I went on and did what I had to do. I turned in a circle three times, clutched that acorn tight, and made my wish. Then I went back to my room and set the acorn on the windowsill. I would leave it there for 3 days to make sure my wish would be even stronger. That's what my Girl Scout leader in Raleigh told me about acorn wishes, and that could not be a lie because Girl Scout leaders do not lie. After supper, we had more blackberry cobbler. Gus went out to the garden to make sure the sprinkler was turned off, and Bertha said, "Stay right here, Charlie. I want to show you something." She went to the room and came back with a tattered shoebox. She took the lid off and said, "Look." I peered inside. Photographs. Bertha rummaged through them and took one out. She smiled at it and handed it to me. "Your mama and me," she said, pointing to the handwriting on the back. "Bertha and Carla," in big printed letters. I took the faded photograph from her. Two young girls sat on the hood of a car with their arms around each other. "Which one's Mama?" I asked. Bertha pointed to the smaller girl. I squinted down at her. She was missing her two front teeth and had a Band-Aid on her elbow. I could not take my eyes off that girl. I imagined her getting down from the car and skipping in circles. I imagined her singing with her big sister Bertha in the back seat of their daddy's car. I imagined her telling knock-knock jokes and roller skating and eating ice cream on the porch at night. When had this gap-toothed little girl turned into that sad woman in her dark bedroom in Raleigh? "Did y'all love each other?" I asked Bertha. "We sure did." Then she showed me some more photographs. Mama opened a present beside a Christmas tree, the two of them playing with a puppy in the snow, Bertha pulling Mama in a wagon on a dirt road. "Why don't y'all see each other anymore?" Bertha let out a big sigh and shook her head. "We grew up," she said. "When you grow up, sometimes life gets complicated." That wasn't a very good answer, but I could tell it was the only one I was going to get, so I just said, "Oh." When Gus came back in from the garden, we went out on the porch. They held hands with Bertha while Bertha told us about some old man selling moldy strawberries from the back of a truck out on Highway 14. And then she said, "You can call Jackie tomorrow if you want to, Charlie." "No, thanks," I said. It was so quiet I could hear Bertha breathing. I could feel her looking at me, but I stared out at the treetops. Charlie, she said, don't be mad at Jackie. I'm not mad at Jackie, I said, but that lie was like a dark cloud settling over us. I was mad at Jackie. She acted like she didn't have one single trouble hanging on her line, and she didn't care one bit about me. Then we sat there in silence, breathing in the cool night air and listening to the crickets under the porch. That night when I went to bed, I laid there in the dark and pictured a clothesline full of somebody else's troubles. I knew for sure there were a lot of them I'd rather pluck off that line than mine. I imagined what the other troubles might be. There would probably be toothaches and failed math tests, lost cats and ugly hair, cheating boyfriends and broken down cars, but none of those could hold a candle to my troubles, weighing down that clothesline like a sack full of bricks. I tiptoed to the window and stared out into the night, thinking maybe I'd see a falling star to wish on. The moon was bright over the mountains and sent a shimmering glow across the yard, making shadows that snaked around the dogwood tree and crept along the garden fence. I knew Wishbone was out there somewhere all by himself. I wondered what he was doing, eating stale bread out of somebody's garbage, trotting along the highway in the moonlight, sleeping under somebody's porch. I hope Gus wasn't right about Wishbone wanting to be a stray, but then I remembered how he had wagged his tail at me that day. He liked me, I was sure of it, and if he was mine and didn't have to be a stray anymore, I bet he would love me. I clasped my hands together like I was praying and whispered into the darkness, "Please come back, Wishbone."